Welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist Radio Show with host Karen Rands. A compassionate capitalist is someone who invests their money into entrepreneur endeavors to bring innovation to the market, impact their community, create jobs, and generate wealth for all those involved. Karen and her guests share insights and best practices for entrepreneurs to succeed and scale their business and investors to share in that success without all the risks. And now.
Hey, this is Karen Rands, just stepping in here to give a quick intro. This is one of two that I interviewed investors, the people that either are the lead of an investor group in screening deals or have actually established an angel investor group that invest in life sciences companies, biomed, biotech in that particular sector. And I, if you missed the episode from last week, which was with Tegan Blumenthal of Life Science Angels, please go back and listen to that. This one in particular is with a group, Yaniv Schnorr out of Connecticut with the Bio Angels up there. And they both, they approach it differently in the way that they go about it. It's really important for those that are interested in investing in biotech, biomed, life sciences, and even for the companies that are trying to bring products to market. Both of these episodes that last week and this week will help you understand some of the criteria and the process that investors go through for that sector. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in, and please share. So yes, welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist podcast. And of course, today we're doing it also as a video. I'm Karen Rands, and my guest today, Yaniv Schnorr, is very special that we have him on the show. And part of the reason why, and I'll explain things to as I introduce him, is when people get involved with angel investing, when they get involved and they decide that they're going to be this compassionate capitalist that's going to take a portion of their liquidity or their set aside for their investment portfolio and decide how are they going to get involved in investing in entrepreneurs, one of the first rules that I tell people is, you know, you invest in something that you know. And then you also want to diversify by industry and stage and things like that. But one of the areas that seems to be very elusive to a lot of investors that may focus on technology because they understand technology, or they may focus on, you know, some kind of consumer product or things like that, is in the world of life sciences and with therapeutics and biomed and devices and all of this broad spectrum of things that are involved in the healthcare system that, you know, truly, you know, in theory, at every piece of the moment is going to advance humanity and benefit humanity because it's solving a medical problem or solving an ailment or helping people cope with a medical ailment that they may have or function. And so, but it's a little bit different in the life cycle of what a bio angel would invest in. And it's and a lot of times, like when I've worked with my angel group, you know, it's difficult to compare the pathways for funding, for milestone progress with a life sciences type of a company, with a technology type of a company. So when you can find somebody like Yaniv Schnorr that is an expert in this area, that has not only identified it as something for his own investments, but also pulled together a group of other people that want to invest in that as well, and the processes for successfully analyzing that, that's a gold mine. So welcome to the show, Yaniv. I'm so happy to have you here today.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So let me give you a little bit of idea about why I think this is so special and my guest here. So he is one of the founders of MABA. It's the Mid-Atlantic Bio Angels, or bioangels.net. It's a life sciences angel investor group where he administers do you say it MABA or MABA?
We call it MABA.
MABA. Internal investment pools, the MABA's co-investment sidecar fund, which that website is also sidecarfund.bioangels.net for the non-MABA members. So Mr. Schnorr is the CEO of Native State Therapeutics, And it's an early stage biotechnology company in the neurodegeneration field. And the president of Blue Cactus Consulting, which is bluecactusconsulting.com, which is a business strategy consulting group. And you'll hear how that kind of connects up with the recipe, I have Yaniv explain more about his journey to be this. But so Yaniv was originally a physicist. He made the transition into the business world about 30 years ago, at which point he took the helm of his first company. He has been the senior merger, acquisition, capitalization, turnaround leadership experience with companies ranging from startup to growth. He's held positions as the CEO, COO, president, and general manager at a number of companies, including a bioinformatics company, a surgical laser company, a manufacturer and distribution company, a software and network integration company, and several others. And of course, I could go on and on with that as well. But I would like you to, Yaniv, could you explain to our listeners and our watchers, our viewers, how you came from, you know, this background in as a physicist into becoming an entrepreneur? Because we know that experience as an entrepreneur is incredibly valuable to the decision-making process when you're evaluating companies for investment, because you've sat at and you've held different, you've had the different hats on in many different roles and in different companies. So you have a broad spectrum of experience, particularly as you apply it to life sciences. So connect the dots for us a bit.
Sure. So I did start off more on the, I started off as a programmer, analyst, learned to program, and eventually started going out and doing the sales activities for the programming house that I worked for and doing the analysis work. And I really fell in love with the client interaction and the business aspect of it. And when certain conditions happened in the company, I ended up taking over the management of 2/3 of the business, the programming and the hardware maintenance part of it. And really fell in love with the business management, with marketing, sales, and all of the business aspects of the business itself, and not just the technology aspects of it. When that company was sold, I really began my journey into entrepreneurship. At that point, I started different companies, started and sold companies, ended up joining the companies that I then turned around, constantly gaining more experience, but more and more on the business end. And at some point after selling a company, I sort of became an accidental consultant that I could tell people, because I decided to start charging for the advice that I was otherwise giving for free. And noticed that many of the companies that I was consulting for who were in the life sciences, that they were having a difficult time raising money for them, simply because it was hard for them to find investors who understood what they were going through. The whole, life sciences is a very complicated area. It involves regulatory, commercialization is not what we're used to from other types of environment. The science is complicated and everything else all around it is very difficult. So together with a few other people, two other partners, we decided to create a group that's dedicated specifically to this otherwise difficult to address area of the life sciences. And within the life sciences, we decided to concentrate on that difficult part of the life sciences, the deep science of the life science, I like to call it, which is the therapeutics, devices, and diagnostics, all those areas that are more challenging to understand and to commercialize and et cetera. And because of that narrow focus, we were able to bring together a group of members who have a lot of experience in that area, whether they're MDs or people who are currently working for life science companies, for the pharma, for the device, for the diagnostic companies. And we also actually have a few of those pharma and device companies as members of our group. And that provides us a lot of depth and understanding in a very narrow area. And an ability to look to, first of all, become a source for those companies who are looking for funding in this area. And also, we think we have the ability to deep dive into those opportunities and to assess whether we would like to invest in them.
Okay, so when it comes to you know, bio and life sciences. Just for our listeners, explain sort of the silos, if you will, because a lot of times people think of pharmaceuticals and, you know, getting FDA approval and all these, you know, you're hearing it a lot right now as we're going through the process of trying to come up with a solution, whether it's therapeutic for COVID or a vaccine for COVID. And everybody talks about that side of it. So, and you're talking about other aspects. So it's a, for our listeners, kind of, you know, separate the categories, if you will, the high level categories, and then and we'll start with that.
So there, the main categories that we like to look at, and I guess everybody can bury it in different things, but the main categories we look at are the therapeutics, which other people would call the drugs.
Okay, so those are the drugs, the same as pharmaceuticals fall within therapeutics?
Yes, pharmaceuticals would fall within
that. Okay, good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have the physical devices, you know, an actual physical thing, piece of hardware that that is involved some way in your healthcare, and then diagnostics, variety of tests, for lack of better words. And again, we like those that are more hardware-based than opposed to just the ones that are software-based, because the things that have more hardware-based to it in the devices and diagnostics have more of intellectual property around them, which is provides them with a stronger position when they ultimately want to sell their product to a large company who wants to buy them. The same thing with pharmaceuticals, where you need to have intellectual property, strong intellectual property, as the basis for any kind of exit. Additional silos that we don't look at, but that do exist, are a variety of healthcare IT, healthcare platforms, mobile health platforms, you know, remote, et cetera, things that are more techie specific, more relying on software, et cetera. These are things that, you know, obviously could be very successful and are growing, especially now, but that we do not invest in because they have a lower intellectual property component, lower IP component. So for us, the main silos are the drugs, the therapeutics, the devices, and the diagnostics.
Okay, great. So when it comes to, you know, the therapeutics, and let's just focus on your two areas, therapeutics and on the device side, do they go through the same FDA type of process? Is it possible for them to get to market without FDA?
So we only focus, we only invest in FDA regulatory products. There's a category of things called nutraceuticals, which are the supplements that you find in a variety of stores, et cetera. We don't invest in those.
Okay.
We don't invest in anything that's a direct-to-consumer either. So we're looking for both, you know, therapeutics obviously have to be regulated by the FDA, but also for devices that go through regulatory path, as well as diagnostics. So everything is regulated.
Now, I've heard sometimes when I've companies, either through the presentations that we used to do in my angel group or because I've go to pitch events, and you'll have somebody that has a therapeutic that they're working and it's a slow process to get to through FDA. So they'll go overseas and it will become something that doctors there will recommend without an American FDA approval. Is that a pathway? Because then are they able to use that? It's almost like it's a live clinical trial without having the formal. They can get outcomes of that helps them when they come back and try to get FDA approval. Is that a recommended or not recommended, or it just sort of depends?
So there are regulatory agencies in most of the world. I don't want to say in all of the world because I don't know the answer to that, but I assume in all of the world. But there are many countries where the regulatory process is equivalent in terms of the rigor that's required and the data, et cetera, where if you do run trials in those countries, you can design them so that the results that you get from those would be valid, would be useful in an FDA kind of application. And whenever we do invest in companies, FDA and US approval must be a significant component of their commercialization process. We also assume that those companies would want to enter markets in Europe, because that's an equally large market as is the US, and many also pursue commercialization in Japan, sometimes in South America, et cetera. So it all depends on how much money they have. And there are many countries that you can go through and get data that it would be on par, or you know, and the whole process would be on par, so that you could use that data in your FDA filing. But every country or every area requires its own type of filing.
Okay, so there is some sort of, not so much reciprocal, but there's been standards established within the major markets that say if you get to this level, then it bypasses maybe at level one and two, you're not all the way to the top, but they do have some standardization of standards across their qualifications.
You do have to file in every country every area in which you want approval. And there are certain standards for that data. And when you build a trial or when you build that data, you need to talk to the regulatory agency within that area, and you can have discussions with them and say, what kind of trial are you going to require? What kind of data are you going to require? And so when you embark on your regulatory strategy, you want to make sure that whatever your data you produce in one area can be used in the other, because you don't want to repeat. It's very expensive to have clinical trials.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that when you do a trial or when you produce some data, it's useful in all the areas in which you want to make sure. So you begin with discussions with the regulatory agencies. You get their buy-in into your program. And once you know what all of them need, you can produce your trial. You can design your trial so that it matches all of their demands, so that when you end up with that with the data, you can then use it to file in all the areas. You don't have to repeat anything. You don't have to start from new.
So I want to get into how MABA does its uses that as part of its screening process. But first, let's take a small step back and say, so you started the BioAngels a decade ago.
So there are three partners who started MABA about 8 years ago, just over 8 years ago. Yeah, we began doing our diligence. So we noticed that there was a need in the marketplace for this kind of group. So we began to do diligence on it about a decade ago.
Okay.
And then spoke to enough people and enough other groups and decided that in fact there is a demand or there is a need for such a group to exist. And we started it officially about just a little bit more than 8 years ago.
And how many members do you have now?
We have approximately 50 active members, 50.
Yeah. And I recall from our initial conversation, they're very active. I think your membership and your requirements are more active than the average angel group that I've encountered in what they do. So describe a little bit about that process of how you've identified, encouraged, recruited, and the level of commitment that your members have, even within the environment that we deal with now, to be involved in the process of screening and evaluating and identifying opportunities.
So, you know, we started our group, and then the first thing we did is recruit a screening committee, sort of a board for our group, and a steering committee. And that group sort of created the charter for what we want to do, you know, where we're going to invest, what kind of companies we're going to invest in, what should we really look at, how do we differentiate ourselves, how do we differentiate the companies, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a process that continues to evolve. We still have a very active steering committee, and they continue to advise us to help us chart our path forward in terms of what we want to do and what we want to be and how we want to operate. And they also help us screen through the activities of the group, and screen the companies that apply to the group. And as we looked at the membership in the group and how we structured it, et cetera, we decided that the best way to do it for individual members is, rather than charge a membership fee from the individuals, that their fee is their work. So we tell members, in order for you to become and to maintain your membership, you have to work. You have to be actively involved. You have to show up to at least half the meetings a year. You have to participate and contribute to the diligence process. You have to be interested in investing at least a certain minimum on an annual basis. And if not, you know, we tell people, we recognize that being an angel investor means that you have at least one day job, one additional day job, maybe two other day jobs, and that's fine. And if those day jobs call on you and require your full attention, please dedicate your attention to those, be successful, come back to us when you have more time and money to be fully engaged. But if you are, if you want to call yourself a member, if you want to be a member, please, you know, dedicate the time to becoming, to be an active member. Otherwise, you won't be able to continue your membership.
And are they mostly, are they scientists, doctors, regular business folks that have an interest in life sciences, just or a broad spectrum, or do they, you know, what's the makeup of your group?
So as you alluded to in the past, you know, people invest in what they know and understand. And this is an area that's a little bit difficult to know and understand. So by definition, the people who gravitate to a group like ours are people who understand not only the science, but the business of that science. So we have many MDs in the group, but we also have people who work for pharma companies or consultant for pharma and device companies. And as I mentioned, we have some pharma and device companies as members of the group as well. So we have people who understand the scientific part of it, the regulatory part of it, the business part of it, the commercial part of it, the financial part of it, because there are so many, you know, the aspects of it, even the people part of the life science business. And for whatever reason are attracted to it and want to be investing in it. So it's, you know, we do have a lot of scientific expertise and acumen, but also a lot of commercial expertise in the group focusing on the life sciences.
So when it comes to the intellectual property, which is such a big point of, I guess, a starting point, and one of the challenges I know when it comes to drug discovery, let's say, or some of this, you know, and filing, one is figuring out what's out there. Then it's, can you get a patent for what it is that you're working on? And there's, you know, really rich databases and a lot of stuff that goes on internal to these pharmaceuticals, you know, compared to what might be coming out of a lab in a university or things like that. So it seems like I always have companies that say they want you to sign a non-disclosure. And a lot of times investors are like, no way, we're not signing it because we're just never know what we've seen already. And it's never know what we're going to see. So we just don't. Your intellectual property has to be protected by the patent. Everything else is, you know, not protectable or whatever. It seems like you would almost have a deeper level of that, given that you have members that are active in pharmaceutical companies now, and part of what they may, not only for on their personal side, but they also might be looking for where their company might see a potential for an acquisition. So how do you navigate that sort of shark-infested waters of those concerns of the entrepreneurs? And particularly when you're looking at some deals that aren't even in the United States.
So first of all, as you alluded again, we do not sign non-disclosures. It's impossible for us to bind a group of members to non-disclosure. And we make sure to let every company know that their application is not confidential, and only all the correspondence with us is not confidential, and that their presentation to us, if they get to that level, is not confidential. And there really is a lot of information and a lot of discussion that you can have with investors without ever revealing any confidential information. If you talk about features and benefits, if you talk about, you know, what you achieve, et cetera, you don't have to go into the specific mechanisms of action or specifics of the patent. So that's number one. Number two, most of the time, by the time somebody presents to us or applies to us, they already have patents that they have applied for. Once you've applied for those patents, you have established your rights or initial rights to them. All depends on what the patent office then grants you or not. But if you discuss what's in those patent applications, you're covered. You know, you're not making a public disclosure anymore, which will hurt you, and you're not revealing anymore that you've already asked for from the patent office. So you shouldn't have an issue with that as well. if you want to disclose something that's beyond what you already filed for, if we do get into due diligence, in some cases, a few of the individual investors might say, you know what, we'll sign a non-disclosure just to be able to get that additional information. And actually, sometimes that additional information is not necessarily patents. Sometimes it could be discussions that they're currently having with strategics that they don't want to have public. It could be other types of information, like discussions they've had with the FDA, et cetera. And so one or two members might say, you know what, I'll sign this individually. I cannot reveal afterwards to you what I saw, but I can tell you what my impression is
of
what I saw. And so, you know, they'll say, I saw, you know, documents and discussions, you know, with the patent office, et cetera, et cetera. It looks promising. Or based on that, I feel pretty good in terms of proceeding forward. So that could be a strategy. And we only employ those during the due diligence and very sparingly. And individuals have to decide if they want to sign it. We can't make anybody sign non-disclosure because it binds them individually. So individuals basically make that decision for themselves. And some do and some don't.
Yes. Okay. So now you guys, how many investments do you have active right now with BioAngels?
So we have about 13 investments active. So just to give you some of our statistics, of every 100 applications we receive, we only invite about a quarter of them to present in person. We reject about 76 companies in the first screening for a variety of reasons. We tell all the companies why we reject them. So just That's to give good. Them a chance to maybe come back in the future or to tell us if we're wrong or whatever it is. Of the 24 that move on to present in person, about 16 go into diligence. And of those 16, about 2 receive investment. So it's a 2% yield for us. So we've seen approximately 800 applications in the last 8 years, about 100 plus a year. We invested in 13 companies. There's a current investment potentially in process right now to be our 14th. But of those 13, all the companies are still alive and doing well, which is great to say. You know, it could change tomorrow, but still doing that. We had one company that exited, and we had another. We have a few companies. So the majority of our investment window is we're expecting an exit between 5 to 7 years. We obviously have no control over it, but that's what our expectation is. If it's much longer than that, we try not to invest. But the majority of our investments have been in the last 4 years or so. So we are hoping and expecting that within the next year or two, we'll begin to see a few more exits coming down the pike.
Yes, that's good. So describe a bit about of when they're coming through, is there some things that are easy to dismiss based on stage or industry? I know when we talked before, you talked about part of your criteria is the size of the market and then how much money they're going to actually need to get to that market, so that you're protecting your investors' investments in this early stage phase.
So there are a few things that we look for when we consider an investment. Number one is the strength of the management team. So the first thing that we invest in really is the management, the people who are capable of bringing this to a successful exit. Somebody just, people who can inspire us that they know what they're doing and that they'll do well with the money that we put into them. The second thing we're looking for are products that will change the standard of care. So we're not looking for anything that's incremental, just a little bit better, just slightly better mousetrap. We're looking for something that will make doctors operate in a different way, literally. The third thing that we're looking for are large and growing markets, because only those will provide a significant enough type of exit to a company. If it's a small market, maybe they won't be purchased, or if they are, they're going to be purchased for a small amount, and it won't compensate for the amount of risk that you take with these kind of investments. Another thing we look for is opportunities that we call, and it's our own definition, but we call them angel-only opportunities. We divide the world, and again, it's our own personal definition, but we divide the world into angel opportunities and venture capital opportunities. Angel opportunities are those that will require maybe $15 or $20 million or less in dilutive funding to reach an exit. So you take $15 million and you generate enough data that somebody is going to want to buy you. If you need more than that, if it's $30, $40, $50 million and up, we really see it as a VC opportunity. And we recommend companies talk to the VCs straight on, get to know them. Maybe they'll make an early investment in them, and knowing that they would later on make the larger investments in them. But when it comes to such large amounts of money, we get diluted too heavily, and it doesn't make sense for us as investors to invest in. When you look at $15 or $20 million, we've seen it possible for companies to raise that kind of money in multiple syndicated rounds. So angel groups are very friendly with each other. You know, when we invest in a company, we'll gladly call other angel groups and say, hey, we just put money into this company. We're now vested in their success. Do you want to take a look at them as well? And usually we say yes to each other. We want to see what other people thought was worthy. And we've seen those kind of syndicated rounds go for between $2 to $5 million invested by multiple groups in a round. And we've seen companies that have raised 3 or 4 of those rounds. So we know that that's feasible in the angel community, and we like to invest in those opportunities that will be, you know, angel only if we can make sure of that, to the extent that we can make sure of that.
Okay. So, are there a lot of other bio angel groups, or because you've taken the lead and done the due diligence on this, there'll be, you know, a tech group or somebody that overlays into life sciences, but they're sort of a broad spectrum. They only do maybe an occasional life sciences that looks really good or fits in theirs, particularly if it's a device kind of a thing that overlaps. Or so how do you go about with a syndication like that?
The majority of angel groups in the world really invest in a broad spectrum of things. And depending on their membership, they might also invest in therapeutics or devices, because if there's somebody or somebodies within that group who understand that, then they would tend to follow those folks' advice and invest. As I mentioned, life sciences are difficult things to understand. And people really only invest in things that they know and understand and can relate to and like. So there are very few groups that focus specifically in the life sciences. Some of them focus on life sciences, but also include the tech side of the life sciences, the healthcare IT, et cetera, which we don't do. I don't think that there are any in the world that do just the hardware, the deep science of the life sciences, as we do, just the therapeutics, devices, and diagnostics.
Yeah. So when you mentioned the management team, so is it important for the management team to have already been around the block once with this, or could they have business acumen from someplace else that they're applying, and a team of a scientist and a business person, or it just really depends on the situation?
So, it really depends on the situation. What you really want is for somebody to walk in the room and for you to feel as an investor that they're being honest with you, but also to feel that they know what they're doing. And usually they know what they're doing because they have certain experience and they've done it in the past, but not always. It's enough that somebody has been able to be in doing what they're doing for long enough. Even if it's a specific opportunity they're involved with, that they know the path, they understand what it takes to get there. They can make a convincing argument as to the commercialization path. They've spoken to the right people. They've done all the right thing. They have all the people supporting them that they could and they need to, and they make a convincing argument, and we would be happy to invest in those folks.
Yeah. And then when you talk about a small market versus a large market, what is your definition of a large market?
So service companies, by definition, are small companies, small market companies, right? We're looking for markets that could be multi-billion dollar markets, because then there's an incentive for a large pharma or a large device company to come and say, you know what, maybe you can take it up to a certain level, but we can certainly take it to the next level. It can significantly enhance our bottom line. And there's enough of a market there for us to be interested in, especially, when you want a large pharma to buy somebody early, with early data, et cetera. You want them to be that pharma company to be excited about the market potential and just wait to see enough data before they say, this is enough for us to know that this is something we want to add to our portfolio. But it needs to be, the more exciting, the more large, the more growing, the more developing market it is, the more chance of that reaching an exit.
Yeah. So when I sort of overlay or align it with, you know, technology investments, right? And the life cycle of a technology investment, you know, it's usually, oh, they've got to have a patent filed or something. They have to have a minimum viable product. They have to have some kind of a test or a user test, a market validation. And that's considered, you know, beyond the idea stage into the startup stage that starts to get the attention of most of your traditional angel groups, you know, and the more progress with customers or traction or eyeballs or whatever it is, you know, they can get through these other rounds. So compare that on the life sciences side, you know, where that is, because there's, you know, a petri dish to people, you know, it's like, is there some, yeah, sort of, you know, where is it where it's too early stage because it's still just, you know, and where does simulations, like computer simulations of outcomes or artificial intelligence, does that play in evaluating the progress of a therapeutic at all?
Yeah, so there are a lot of, hopefully I'll remember all the different parts of your question when I answer you. So, you know, as life science companies are going to take a lot longer than your traditional tech companies. You know, 5 to 7 years for an exit, sometimes longer, but 5 to 7 years where your tech exit, you expect it to happen sooner. They're going to require more money, usually, you know, 50 to 100% more in terms of investment, or even more than that. The rounds in life sciences are usually larger than the tech investments. There is no minimum viable product. There are no customers.
Right.
Those things are things that are foreign to us, you know, that we don't ever or hardly ever see. Usually, especially when it comes to therapeutics. I mean, with devices, you do see companies that have traction, and traction will be required by the acquiring company to before usually those kind of companies can exit devices and diagnostics.
So just real quick, so traction could be where they are in clinical trials.
Well, traction is where they either, they have enough data to enter the market and they have approval to enter the market.
Oh.
It's to begin to sell products and have traction. And that's for device and diagnostic companies where the clinical path is shorter and less expensive than drugs. And the companies that acquire those kind of startups require usually some form of traction before they end up buying those companies. But when you talk about therapeutics, you usually don't even have first-in-man data. There are no clinical trials at that point. It's simply, is there enough data to suggest that what you have makes sense, that it will work? We work a lot of based on hypotheses of, we think that this disease progresses for the following reasons, and we think that if we go after this specific part of this specific mechanism, we can inhibit it, and here is the proof, or here's the data that shows why it can, or here are other things that have gone after it with some form of success, but here is why our what we're trying to do makes sense. And we try to look at basically say, hey, you know, in the last 10 years, did such and such company try to do something similar, and were they successful, or is this considered to be promising, and, you know, what do we think of the approach, and what do you think of their success to you know, their chances of being successful doing this and then being acquired, et cetera, et cetera. You know, as it's interesting because we invest in those therapeutic companies, and the goal is for them to be able to be acquired by a large pharma company. So they need to generate enough data that they can convince a potential large acquirer. You still may not have all the data that you should, all the proof that you need, this in fact works. You're just trying to generate more and more data to suggest that there's good reason why it should.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that it's not a better mousetrap, but when it comes to solving some of your medical problems and therapeutics, and even within, I guess, your company, where you're looking at Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and there's things that people are doing now, and even with cancer treatments, but we're always trying to find something better, right? So
we're trying to find something.
Yeah, right.
In some cases, when you try to find something better, it means you want to improve the length of survival. You want to improve the outcomes. But we want something that will improve outcomes in a brand new way, in a much greater way, where it's where doctors would stop prescribing the one thing and would now to move on to prescribing the new thing that we invested in, that would stop using doing surgery in a certain way and do surgery in a new way. That's what we talk about, something that's not incremental, but would change the standard of care.
Okay, okay. So now, you know, part of what I mentioned at the very beginning when I talk about, and of course the purpose of my book, Inside Secrets to Angel Investing, is to bring, you know, net new investors into the marketplace that may not have known about the opportunity to invest in private companies. But, you know, now that they know because of the Jobs Act and greater access to that, and just more, you know, knowledge in the world about companies that have come to market as a result of angel investing and the outcomes and the wealth that's been created from that, you know, it's all about deciding how you play based on time, location, you know, money, how much can you participate. That dictates the stage based on the type of money you have. And I was very encouraged by the fact that, you know, if, because a lot of times investors will, part of their reason to get involved in the compassion side is that they have an emotional connection to something. And when it comes to healthcare and the therapeutics and the pharmaceuticals and the various things that the bioangels focus on, there's a lot of emotional connection for people that have been, had their lives impacted because of not having a solution in the marketplace. And so I was very encouraged to find out that even if people aren't located in your geography where they can be at 50% of the meetings at a minimum, they have direct knowledge to contribute to it, they can participate in the success that you're building with your sidecar fund. So talk about right. How you got that started, where how the members came about saying, hey, we should do this. And because you all do have now, particularly with everything so virtual, you're establishing a lot of connections with people outside of your geography. So tell our listeners and our viewers about the Sidecar Fund and how they might learn more about that.
Sure. So it's an evolutionary process. So we started off as a group that invests as individuals our own money. And then we said, you know what? What if we pooled our own money together in what we call internal pools, and we vote on how those pools invest. And the reason is that sometimes maybe you'd say, you know what, I'm on the fence about investing in a certain company, but you get dragged into that opportunity anyway, and you're happy that you were. So the pools and allow us to, A, have a very dynamic discussions around our investments, because our members who are active are the people who are limited partners within those pools, and they have to vote at the end of the day whether that pool invests or not. And it causes a vibrant discussion, but also allows us to be dragged in and drag others into internally other investments that we wouldn't necessarily go into. And it also allows us to have exposure into a lot of different deals. So it provides us internal diversification also into deals, et cetera. And at some point we said, no, this is great, but what happens if you are somebody who wants to invest in life sciences, but as you said, lives too far away, doesn't have enough expertise, doesn't have the time or whatever it is, but still wants some kind of investment in this asset class. So for those people, we created what we call the Sidecar Fund. And that Sidecar Fund works on a rule-based system. So it has specific rules, and if those rules are met, it automatically co-invests with us. So the idea is, if we like something and we do our own diligence and we put our own money into it, which means we took our own risk on that investment, and a few other rules are met, the Sidecar Fund automatically co-invests with us. So it's like an index fund that indexes our investments automatically. There's no questions, there's nobody providing advice whether you should or shouldn't. Basically, it's automatic. Certain things happen, it invests. Certain things don't happen, it doesn't.
Very good. Okay, so then when it comes to the investment, and say you're syndicating it, you've got your sidecar admitted, you know, it might, out of what you, would it be 25% of your total investment out of the bioangels that might add on, or is it an equal amount, or?
It's different every time.
Okay.
You know, The investors decide how much they invest. The pool investment amounts are fixed. The sidecar fund investments are fixed because there are certain ratios and rules in place. But how much the individual members invest is not. And so that really depends on the company and the how much energy and excitement they're able to generate around the opportunity. So in some cases, yes, maybe the pool or the fund provide a quarter of that total investment. In some cases, it might be smaller.
So when life sciences companies are going through the process, they have potential to have three buckets that they can draw for investment out of your group. That's really encouraging.
And that's one of the reasons why we look at it as a win-win-win, because you know, for us, we're able to come into rounds now with larger investments, which is means that we potentially have more influence during the round, maybe, and we also become a more attractive investors for companies considering it. For the companies who are looking for investment, when they come to us, they can get a lot more money because they can get money from all those three buckets. And for the sidecar funds, they get exposure to deals that we already took the risk on, and they are able to participate in those on the exact same terms as we invest in.
Okay, very good. So I want to encourage folks, now that we've just covered this, make sure bioangels.net is the website to go to. And that, is that where companies
apply? That's where the companies would apply as well, under the entrepreneurs tab.
And then you probably have a link on there to the sidecar where people can get more information.
Correct.
They go straight there. So all of the stuff that they need to get access to your group, to you, to look at the current portfolio, if they're interested in touching base with you to check on status, to see if there's some additional follow-on funds needed for one of the companies that you are currently invested in, they could, have conversations with you about that?
So you only have access to the deals that we've invested in if you're a member.
Oh, okay. You mean as far as, I was thinking more when you, under like your investments, that if another fund, let's say that hadn't heard of you, was interested in a deal, they would be able to touch base with you to see if they're going to be doing another round or something like that?
Sure. Even though we do proactively reach out on behalf of our companies, of our portfolio companies, when they are raising, and if they need additional money, we do actively reach out to other angel groups and say, hey, this company's raising money or raising additional money. If you're interested in taking a look at them, we'll introduce them to you in whichever way you prefer.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm really pleased to have met you at the family office events and understand that you have this dynamic group that with such experience and so active in identifying these companies that are worthy of funding and in making the investments, and also in the best practices that I think that you have of informing those that apply why it didn't fit what your requirements are, so that it's, because that's really important for entrepreneurs to know where they missed the boat and if it's something that they can tweak, or they just know that they're just kind of barking up the wrong tree, whatever that may be, they're informed. And they're not just in language. It's one of the worst things as I work with entrepreneurs when you go through one of these application processes and you never hear anything and you just don't, and when I've done some of these other podcasts with people on the due diligence side, things are, when you're a startup, things are fast moving. And if it takes months and months to get any kind of feedback, sometimes the things that they didn't like before have already changed. And so it's good to be able to get feedback in a timely manner so you know a different direction you might need to take as an entrepreneur.
So a few other things to that. The yes, last question do. Our questionnaire, we do tell companies, if you've applied in the past have been rejected, remind us why you were rejected last time and tell us what's changed since then. So we encourage companies to reapply. But we also run a series of events called First Pitch Life Science, and you can find it under firstpitchlifescience.com. which is sort of evolved into sort of office hours. It's a series of open events, even though we don't advertise to people, the link to join it. The companies who do get involved with it can invite anybody who wants to. And these are companies who are too early for investment, who can pitch to us We usually have during a pitch session three or four companies. They pitch to us for 10 minutes and then we give them feedback. The only thing they do is pitch for feedback, and we tell them what we liked or what we didn't like, what concerns we had about their applications, what we think they should do, et cetera, just for feedback so that they could use that in the future when they're ready. They've had, you know, and they can ask us any questions they want. They can engage us in conversation. They can ask us questions about the investment process. Some of the questions you asked today, they ask us as well, and receive specific feedback on their specific type of pitch from a variety of members of panelists in our group. And we do that also now on a monthly basis, just before our MAPA meetings. So, and we do that all virtually through Zoom, and we have companies from all over the world who come and pitch to us and provide and receive feedback.
That's terrific.
That's another way to interact with the ecosystem and to help companies that hopefully one day will be, you know, is investment worthy.
Yeah. So that was First Pitch event.
Firstpitchlifescience.com.
Not plural on the science.
Correct.
Okay. Firstpitchlifescience.com. Great. So as we're wrapping up here, anything else that you would like to add, Yaniv?
No, I thank you so much for inviting me and for this lovely and engaging conversation. Good luck to you with all of your activities as well. I know you're very active within the angel community. So thank you for all that you do.
Yes, and thank you very much. I've learned a good deal. It's been one of the things when I talk about why compassionate capitalism, you know, yeah, sure, it's bringing innovation to the market, create jobs and create wealth for all those involved. But what really sticks in the back of my head and in my heart is when I've had some of these life sciences companies that would come through our angel group, and I could see the benefit of what it was that they were trying to do. I could see the problem that they were trying to solve. And because of my particular group not having, you know, deep experience in that, a lot of times they wouldn't qualify for funding in ours because people just couldn't overcome the fear of how much money it was going to take or how long it was going to take for them to get to market. So they wouldn't give this money that they needed to get to just that next level. And it was just, I always think how heartbreaking it is that some of these solutions, solutions to problems that we have, don't get to market, and the lives that aren't saved or the lives that aren't bettered by it because they just, you know, didn't connect with the right investor group. And so knowing that you're out there and that this first pitch event is really terrific, you know, that it's, that they're, and the sidecar fund, because I want people to diversify, you know, just like you would in a stock portfolio. You know,
exactly.
If you're going out there buying a pharmaceutical stock that you think it has potential, just like you're buying a tech company stock or you're buying this, the same thing needs to happen when it comes to the private side on the companies that are on their way up to become those kind of companies or become something that's in the portfolio of the company that you have a public stock acquisition of.
Yeah. And I do believe very much in the philosophy of finding people with specific expertise and then, you know, indexing what they're investing in. So if somebody's an expert in a specific area of tech or whatever it is, you know, those are the people who have a better chance of making the better kind of investment decisions. I want to invest with them. And if I don't have the bandwidth to be active there, a sidecar fund would be a perfect way of doing that.
Absolutely. Terrific. I'm so glad you did that as well. And we will stay in touch. You're going to be on my fast dial list when those kind of opportunities come my way, but through the channels, through all the proper channels.
Absolutely through the channels.
All right. Thank you very much, Yaniv, and stay safe and well, and good luck with everything. And with that, there will be, for folks who are still listening on the podcast, there's a little bit of a exit reel that'll be playing here. And I just wanted to thank you and say onwards and upwards.
Thank you so much, Karen. Same to you. All the best.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, The Compassionate Capitalist Show, brought to you by Cougaran Capital Holdings with Karen Rands as host. You are encouraged to visit the website, cougaran.com, to learn more about how Karen and her team help investors and angel groups make money by avoiding investing in deals that suck, and how the Cougaran Capital companies and partners help entrepreneurs break through their barriers to capital and live their dream by building companies that can scale and create generational wealth for their founders and investors. If your business could benefit from exposure to our audience of business executives, entrepreneurs, and investors, we are seeking financial partners and sponsors for the Compassionate Capitalist Show to help us take this podcast beyond our 150,000 listeners and amplify the message of the Compassionate Capitalist movement by making this a top 50 business podcast. The Compassionate Capitalist Show is available on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, and Google Podcasts. Contact us at KarenRanz.co to learn more. And as a listener, you can do your part of the Compassionate Capitalist movement by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts and sharing this show with your friends and colleagues. Be sure to pick up your copy of Karen's bestseller that launched the Compassionate Capitalist movement, Inside Secrets to Angel Investing, a step-by-step strategies to leverage private equity investment for passive wealth creation. Thank you for listening.